Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Braxton Bragg, The Most Hated Man of the Confederacy, by Earl J. Hess. Narrated by Jonathan Yen. Preface. Braxton Bragg has always been a controversial figure of the Civil War. His contemporaries began the process of making him into a hero, a fool, a bloodthirsty disciplinarian, and an old-fashioned scapegoat, all wrapped up in one package. Historians have tended to do similar things, followed by a legion of Civil War enthusiasts who seem to delight in making of Bragg the Confederacy's chief whipping boy. It is not easy to gain a proper perspective on Bragg because of these kaleidoscopic views of his personality and generalship. His image has been warped and tainted by them. One need only mention his name at a Civil War roundtable meeting to bring a guffaw from someone who will make a snide comment about the general. Nearly everyone has a negative view of Bragg, and yet he remains one of the most popular figures of the Civil War. Even those who think poorly of his war career are fascinated by it, and almost any group of Civil War students or historians will engage in a heated discussion about his impact on the course of the conflict. This book is an effort to understand many things about Bragg, the man, and the Civil War general. To understand the man, it delves into his personality, his family life, and his views of Southern culture when slavery was at its height and most of the South fought a desperate war for independence. Bragg fully embraced that war because he had come to embrace the plantation culture that he thought was at the heart of the Southern independence movement. Bragg's career as a Confederate general is probed deeply, including the many controversies surrounding his handling of Confederate troops in the field. The connections between Bragg's personal life and his military career are explored as well. The deep and intense controversies about his generalship, unfortunately, have had the effect of dehumanizing Bragg. He has become almost a cardboard figure among Civil War enthusiasts and even among some professional historians. This book is a study of Braxton Bragg's Civil War career, not a full-fledged biography of the man. It also is not simply a generic narrative of the campaigns and battles he conducted, a fault of too many histories of prominent figures in the conflict. How Bragg handled his army in the field is important, but the reaction of a myriad of people to his success or failure as a general is even more important in this study. His immediate colleagues, his chief subordinates, and the middle-ranking officers and privates in his command all had differing opinions of their general. Men and women in the civilian society of the South had their views, and prominent politicians in Richmond also formed their assessments of Bragg. Even his federal opponents weighed in with evaluations on their gray-clad adversary. Digging deeply into all these opinions and weighing their significance on Bragg's ability to command are important objectives of this work. But it is also important to understand how these opinions affected Bragg the man as well as the general. Historians have tended to see Bragg as the actor in creating a circle of negativity around him. But we also must understand that he was in turn deeply affected by the actions and opinions of others. Setting Bragg within his proper context is another important objective of this book. Comparing his Civil War career with that of other generals, especially Robert E. Lee, helps us to understand whether he really deserves to be blamed for causing Confederate defeat. In other words, did the problems inhibiting Bragg's ability to win campaigns and battles stem mostly from his own failings or from a set of strategic problems encountered by all other rebel generals? Could Lee have done better if plucked from the Army of Northern Virginia and planted in the Army of Tennessee? How did Bragg's generalship at Stone's River compare to that of Lee at Chancellorsville? Comparison and context always enlighten historical questions in one way or another. We must also consider Bragg the family man, the husband and domestic provider. His wife, Elise, was the primary emotional support of his life. Bragg certainly possessed the ability to make and keep male friends, but no one came close to sustaining him in an emotional way as did Elise. Understanding these personal relationships help us to humanize Bragg, turning him from a cardboard figure into a real person with admirable personal qualities as well as distressing personal faults. This book gives shape and contour to Bragg's career as the most hated general of the Confederacy, trying fairly to assess where he deserves credit as well as where he deserves blame. We need to stop automatically assuming Bragg was a bad general, an ogre, who casually shot his men for minor infractions of discipline, or a cold, callous person who deserved the opprobrium heaped upon his head by generals, enlisted men, and civilians alike. Instead, it is important to include his own view of the war and to pay special attention to his supporters, both in and out of the army, in order to counter the tendency among historians to assume he was hated by everyone. Just as most people automatically assume Lee was a great general who made no mistakes, they have placed Bragg at the opposite end of the spectrum and assume he was a bad general who never did anything right. We have to approach Bragg from a clean perspective and take him for what he was, while rejecting the old image that has become a comforting but unfair view of the man and his military career. Bragg's appearance and personality certainly did not invite approach and easy conversation, and that fact severely hampered his popular image. Edmund Kirby Smith described him as a grim old fellow, but a true soldier. Walter Bullock happened to see him at the railroad depot in Salisbury, North Carolina, one day in early 1864, and found him a very stern-looking old man with gray hair, who also had a gray eye and seems to be very restless. Thomas H. Malone, who served on a brigade-level staff in the Army of Tennessee, never forgot the only time he personally interacted with the general. He had the unpleasant task of telling him that a Unionist citizen under arrest had escaped custody. Bragg was displeased, acting in great anger and with an exceedingly harsh manner. Although standing only a few feet away, he did not talk directly to Malone, but communicated with him through one of his own staff members. Of all the officers Malone served under during the war, Bragg was the only one he personally disliked. "General Bragg was a stranger to his men to the last," commented Philip D. Stevenson. Negative views such as these by some of Bragg's contemporaries have often influenced the attitude of students to come. Generations of Civil War historians have succeeded in making Braxton Bragg's name synonymous with pettiness, bitterness, incompetence, and in some cases even paranoia and insanity, as Kenneth W. Noe has aptly put it in his history of the Battle of Perryville. Those historians have included eminent figures such as Bruce Catton, T. Harry Williams, Douglas Southall Freeman, and David Donald, according to Bragg's biographer Grady McWinnie. The first major biographer of Bragg was Don C. Seitz, whose Braxton Bragg, General of the Confederacy, appeared in 1924. It is not a grateful task to write the biography of a much-hated man whose military efforts led to defeat, Seitz wrote in the foreword of his book. Despite that caveat, Seitz was prudent in his judgments about the general. He declared his aim as neither to defend nor vindicate, but to put into concrete form the circle of events around the life of an important figure in the great contest between the states. But Seitz was not a trained historian. As general manager of the New York World, he was an effective writer and managed to gather and consult a pretty good base of primary material for his work. The book is sympathetic to Bragg, but amateurish. Thomas Robson Hay, also an amateur historian, but one who had a deep interest in plumbing the primary sources, criticized Seitz in a long review of the biography for not doing enough research. It is true that Seitz made little effort to analyze anything or craft an effective argument, preferring to provide long quotations from documents and then let readers make up their own minds about Bragg. Those long quotes are about the only way to know how far Seitz's research went, for he did not provide footnotes or a bibliography. Seitz's conclusions are fair, as far as he was able to make them in 1924. He thought Bragg's stern sense of duty and discipline, and the view that he was a pet of Jefferson Davis, were the roots of ill will sent his way by critics. Seitz noted that the Federals generally respected Bragg's ability on and off the battlefield far more than the Confederates. He also felt that Bragg's place in Confederate history remained vitally important no matter what one thought of the man or his generalship. By far the worst treatment accorded Bragg by a historian came from the pen of Stanley Horn, a Tennessee newspaper editor who turned his hand to Civil War history. Horn detested Bragg with a passion. He was critical of every decision made by the general and blamed him for the loss of the Western Confederacy. Horn often made conclusions about Bragg that are clearly disproved by the evidence, in part because he hardly read any primary sources. In fact, his History of the Army of Tennessee, 1941, is based on scant research of any kind. Horn did not even bother to call the army by its correct name from the time it was created in March 1862 until the Army of the Mississippi became the Army of Tennessee 8 months later. Horn was able to conclude, however, that Bragg was personally devoted to the Confederate cause. But he criticized the general for his innate vagueness of purpose and noted his unpopularity with practically everyone he encountered. While Horn excused this, in part, by noting that Bragg suffered chronic health problems, it hardly palliates the hatred Horn felt for the general, which suffuses every chapter that deals with the Bragg era in the Army's history. Thomas L. Connelly's two-volume History of the Army of Tennessee easily supplanted Horn's book on that army and inspired other academic historians to study Bragg as a commander. On the basis of extensive research and delving deeply into the Army's command history, Connelly offered the reader a largely negative view of Bragg. However, many of Connelly's conclusions do not ring true. His worst fault as a leader was probably his constant fear of making a mistake, Connelly wrote in 1967, and his consequent hesitation in committing his troops. He could drill, but he could not engage. He could plan, but he could easily change his mind. These conclusions are difficult to understand, considering that it was Bragg who made the decision to attack at Perryville, Stones River, and Chickamauga, often against the advice of his chief subordinates. Connelly continued to denigrate Bragg's combat effectiveness by arguing that he had lost his nerve and the ability to see a battle to the end. Bragg was not a fighter, in Connelly's view. Ironically, he was speaking in these last two quotes of the time period around July 1862, even before Bragg had an opportunity to demonstrate whether he could command an army on the battlefield. When it came to Bragg's personal life, Connelly made more outlandish claims. Even his letters home to his wife resembled battle reports and lacked any semblance of affection, he wrote. On the contrary, Bragg's personal letters reveal that he was ardently in love with his wife and was not shy about expressing it. Connally also unfairly accused Bragg of having no compassion for others. As surgeon Samuel Stout amply testified, Bragg felt deeply for the welfare of his men, especially when they were wounded or taken ill. Connally further exaggerated Bragg's sense of combativeness in tussles with his subordinates. He never left his enemies any escape mechanism, but instead relished complete victory in any dispute. Within the army, he drove his enemies to the wall, humiliated them, and forced them into the anti-Bragg element. Then he never let the matter subside. There is little evidence to support such a charge. In fact, Bragg acted leniently toward many subordinates who deserved more punishment than he gave them, as seen later in this book. Such figures as Leonidas Polk and Benjamin F. Cheatham got away with a great deal of backbiting against him because Bragg hesitated to act in their cases. Despite his many unsubstantiated conclusions, Connally was able at times to give Bragg the benefit of the doubt by admitting that his tactical and strategic decisions were about the best choices any other general could have made under the circumstances. Grady McWinney authored a prominent biography of Bragg that was published in 1969. It only takes the general up through the midpoint of the Civil War. The study is one of the more even-handed treatments of Bragg, even though the title of the book links his name with Southern failure. I have emphasized how and why Bragg, as commander of the Army of Tennessee, contributed to Confederate defeat, McWinney admitted. My purpose is neither to defend nor to denigrate the man himself, but to untangle many of the exaggerated opinions about him, to present him as his contemporaries saw him and as he saw himself, and to analyze his successes and failures. McWinney succeeded to a large degree in his purpose, but his contribution to our understanding of Bragg's life and army career before the Civil War is more important, in my view, than his contribution to our understanding of Bragg's Civil War experiences. McWinney did admirable research into and clearly explained Bragg's triumph in the Mexican War and his contentious relations with many people high and low in the U.S. Army before the Civil War. Tolerance of those he disliked was impossible, McWinney has stated of Bragg's widespread criticism of many things in the old army. He passed moral judgments quickly and constantly sought to justify his own and his hero's prejudices. He rarely saw more than one side to any question. Things were either right or wrong. People were either good or bad, friends or enemies. Bragg invariably denounced his enemies openly and in the most sarcastic manner. This is a fair assessment of Bragg, the young army officer, but I think his tendency to see others in this way toned down under the pressure of dealing with large armies and his declining health during the Civil War. McWinney reportedly became tired of his work with Bragg and decided not to pursue the second and concluding volume of his projected biography. One of his graduate students, Judith Lee Halleck, continued the work with the publication of Volume 2 in 1991. The study is relatively superficial in research and treatment, but distinguished by Halleck's effort to medically and psychologically analyze Bragg as a way to understand his career. Not only is that a comparatively unusual approach, but the conclusions are speculative at best. For example, she writes, Bragg's harshness may have been prompted by fears of his own inadequacy. His unreasonable efforts to discipline and organize his soldiers may have provided him some measure of comfort as a way of making up for his inadequacies on the battlefield. Such overarching statements beg several questions. Was Bragg's discipline really too harsh? Was the general who authored brilliant tactical victories at Perryville, Stones River, and Chickamauga really inadequate on the battlefield? And do we really need to psychoanalyze Braxton Bragg to understand the man and his career? I argue that the answers to all such questions is no, and will explain why in the rest of the book. Work by Stephen E. Woodworth, Alexander Mendoza, and Peter Cousins has painted Bragg in more positive tones than many previous historians have done. All of them have examined specific aspects of Bragg's career rather than its totality. Woodworth argues that Bragg owed his longevity as commander of the Army of Tennessee to his genuine ability rather than to any supposed friendship with Jefferson Davis. Woodworth has crafted two defenses of Bragg's actions during the Tullahoma campaign and at McLemore's Cove during the Chickamauga campaign, in which he argues that the general's plans were sound and promising, but destroyed by subordinates who had no faith in him. His arguments are convincing. Mendoza has written in similar vein that D.H. Hill failed Bragg during the Chickamauga campaign. Cousins has not been such a forthright defender of Bragg's image, but he has pointed out the general's strengths as well as his weaknesses. Bragg had an excellent strategic mind, Cousins wrote in his history of the Battle of Chickamauga. His campaigns were well conceived. It was in the execution that he faltered. Woodworth also has treated Bragg's personality with care. He was himself highly self-disciplined and valued self-discipline in others. When a person fell short in that trait, as was often the case, Bragg could be a very strict disciplinarian. This had made the troops he commanded some of the best drilled and trained in the Confederate Army. Even so, he exercised a paternal care for his men, seeing to their welfare and even visiting hospitals and making attempts, however clumsy, at joking with them. Yet Bragg's personal limitations inhibited his ability to succeed in command, as Woodworth has recognized. The general lacked the ability to inspire and motivate those around him. One might call it charisma, or simply a winning personality. Woodworth, in fact, faults Bragg for not trying harder to develop good relations with recalcitrant officers under his command. Bragg also failed to develop the kind of relationship with Jefferson Davis that Lee cultivated, a relationship wherein Lee could obtain favors from the Confederate president that allowed him to get rid of poor subordinates and maximize the amount of resources allocated to his army. Samuel J. Martin's recent biography of Bragg, published in 2011, takes a thoroughly positive view of Bragg, but Martin fails to make a convincing case for his view. An amateur historian, Martin's research is good, but somewhat spotty as well. He is to be applauded for seeing Bragg in a way that is different from the general trend among historians, but he too often tends to simply state that Bragg was right in every controversy without crafting an argument to prove his position. Nevertheless, Martin has correctly pointed out that many ideas about Bragg are mere myths that have been taken at face value by generations of historians. He also asserts that Bragg cared for his men, and he blames subordinates such as Leonidas Polk for most of Bragg's battlefield failures. There has never been a comprehensive, balanced presentation of Bragg's life until now, Martin stated early in his book. While I do not think he has written such a study, I agree that no one else has accomplished that feat. A story about Braxton Bragg circulated so widely that it has become commonly accepted as fact. It relates to Bragg's contentious personality and was started by Ulysses S. Grant, who had no evidence that it was true. "I have heard in the old army an anecdote very characteristic of Bragg," Grant wrote in his memoirs, which were published in 1885. Bragg served as both a quartermaster and commissary at an army post before the Civil War. For a time, he also commanded one of the companies at the place. "As commander of the company, he made a requisition upon the quartermaster, himself, for something he wanted. As quartermaster, he declined to fill the requisition, and endorsed on the back of it his reasons for doing so. As company commander, he responded to this, urging that his requisition called for nothing but what he was entitled to, and that it was the duty of the quartermaster to fill it. As quartermaster, he still persisted that he was right." By now, Bragg referred everything to the post commander for his review. That officer was astonished. "My God, Mr. Bragg, you have quarreled with every officer in the army, and now you are quarreling with yourself." Most people who have read this story accept it without question, in part because it is too good to pass up. But there is no reason to believe it is anything more than an amusing story without foundation. Grant himself admitted that he knew nothing of its veracity, and no one else claimed to know that it was true. Grady McWhinney does not say if it is false, but does admit that Grant is the only source for the story. From my own work with Bragg, I cannot believe this story has any foundation in truth. Bragg was a very intelligent and practical man, and the notion that he would waste his time in senseless activity such as this defies belief. Yet the story is emblematic of the problem with Braxton Bragg. Most people's view of the man is such that they readily accept such a farce as real. Such a story actually becomes a substitute for truly understanding a complex and important individual who deserves much more from students and historians than to be made the butt of unfounded ridicule. Two comments on Bragg by contemporaries seem to sum up much of the maligned general's problems. "I believe Bragg lost us our independence," wrote William Dudley Gale, staff officer to Leonidas Polk after the war. Gale offered a damning appraisal of Bragg when describing him as "cruel, yet without courage, obstinate, yet without firmness, restless, yet without enterprise, crafty, yet without strategy, suspicious, envious, jealous, vain, a bantam in success, and a dunghill in disaster, and yet in command of a better army than Hannibal and Scipio had to conquer Rome or Carthage." John C. Spence, who survived the Battle of Stones River at his hometown of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, saw a better side of the man. "Bragg was generally underrated," Spence mused after the war, "and does not at all times get the credit he is entitled to, is sometimes charged by some for the want of tact in the management of his affairs. This may be by those who know the least of what his designs are. He has one trait. He can make a hard fight, and if pushed close, can get out of the way and not be caught. His men respect him, but are not disposed to worship." The passionate denunciation of Gale well represents a general view of Bragg among his detractors, although few expressed it quite as vehemently as the staff officer who married Leonidas Polk's daughter. But Spence's more sober assessment comes far closer to my own. Bragg was an officer of undoubted qualities. He was hard-working, meticulous, detail-oriented, and extremely self-disciplined. The intense way he did everything led him to burn out in his job of guiding the main Confederate field army in the West. Bragg also held the world up to
sample complete. Ready to continue?